It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. October is LGBT History Month, and today on the Carnegie Mellon University campus, CMU's 2013 Kim and Eric Geiler Lecture in the Humanities is being given by award-winning author and gay rights historian George Chauncey. His talk is on homosexuality and the post-World War II urban crisis. Chauncey, the Samuel Knight Professor of History and American Studies at Yale University, is best known for his book, Gay New York, Gender, Urban Culture, and the Making of the Gay Male World, 1890 to 1940. Harrison Apple, currently the artist in residence at CMU's Center for the Arts and Society, was responsible for Mr. Chauncey's appearance at CMU. He is working on a project looking at gay and lesbian nightlife in Pittsburgh between 1960 and 1990 and joins us in Studio A. Harrison Apple, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me here.
How is Mr. Chauncey influential in chronicling gay and lesbian history in the United States?
Well, his work, Gay New York, is a very large piece of gay and lesbian history field. It documents from about 1895 to 1940 the creation of a subcultural world that is not simply men and women living in the shadows, but documents the complexity and the nuances of a complete society that was thriving in Manhattan.
For people growing up in the 21st century, it I'm sure for some is hard to imagine the idea that gay and lesbian Americans would be living in the shadows, living in a subculture. But there was a time not too terribly long ago when this was how people lived for whatever reason. Explain what that was all about.
Well, one clarification is to make that George Chauncey's work about Gay New York is sort of it's a double answer to that question. The most recent history that people know sort of offhand in a sort of household way tends to deal with persecution during the 1950s, directly from federal agencies or some level of understanding that homosexuals were directly under attack during some sort of Red Scare, be what have you, you know, the reason. But in the 1920s, the early 20th century, late 19th century, it wasn't necessarily the case. Homosexuality wasn't so directly persecuted. He also brings it up in another text called Why Marriage. But I think that this piece of work is one of the first in the field to really outlay a nuanced history that is not strictly persecution and it's not strictly liberation. It's talking about with a bevy of historical evidence that there was a very complicated world involved with homosexuality and that it has it's left its trace.
Explain some of what was happening in that world. I realize you can't go into all of it, but there's some pretty interesting aspects.
Sure. One that he talks about in that book would be geography. And so we're talking about where in New York are you finding this evidence, be it from bathhouses or certain types of bars during Prohibition, speakeasies. Cabarets were a large part of this nightlife that led into his research. And in my own research, I'm finding a similar vein. This world of nightlife, this underground is where you find quite a bit of evidence left to describe that there were people living these lives and it wasn't strictly a history of political movement, either active or non-active.
Was it back then the way it sometimes is in certain cities today where people gravitate to the so-called gay clubs because that's where the best entertainment is?
Absolutely. And there was a large following for gay performers. Although there was censorship code, mostly through the film and media industry, that kept that to a certain minimum come the early 20th century.
What kind of censorship are we talking about?
Oh, we're talking about not being able to address any sort of gay or lesbian themes in film, which was becoming the most popular medium for mass consumption. So that puts a large hamper on gay performers. But there was also after the about 1933 when Prohibition ends and bars are starting to open up legally again, there's a level of licensing that is done by the state liquor code discussing who's allowed to be in a bar and who isn't. Now, there's discussions that Prohibition is also trying to rein in an immigrant population, which the government might consider to be too rowdy or somehow not good, proper citizens who will control themselves, you know, with the consumption of alcohol. But there's direct reference as well to the presence of drag queens or homosexuals and their behavior, designating this a ruckus and unruly place worthy of being raided and shut down.
So how does this end up changing the culture of nightlife?
Well, there's certainly the constant threat that your bar will be closed or that there's the threat of an arrest by a vice cop. But his evidence also proves to show that it's not simply a life under the thumb. There's a full and complex life under these laws, under these codes that are one of the most, I guess you could say, one of the first records people look to. But the evidence that he starts to look at, blueprints from bathhouses, narrations from interviews, this is what really fills in the story and tells you that it's not black and white.
So how did Chauncey's work influence your look at gay and lesbian nightlife in Pittsburgh between 1960 and 1990?
Well, with George Chauncey's work, he takes an interesting look at class as well, class being, you know, socioeconomic class. And so when I'm looking at Pittsburgh's nightlife, my introduction to it was actually through documenting an after-hours club in East Liberty, and I found a number of pieces of evidence. It was very much like a time capsule when we walked in. There was the cups on the counter, fat in the fryers, the coolers were full, and this was a party that ended in about 2003. So I'm looking at this evidence, and I start finding pieces that lead me to other clubs, some of which are gay after-hours clubs, and I also start to find out that these were working-class gay and lesbian after-hours clubs. They weren't for the elite. And I think that that assumption that there's an elite gay crowd pervades a lot of the GLBT movement today, and it's a question that everyone's being asked to answer about the pink dollar, or this idea that gays have more expendable income. This history that I'm doing takes a critical look at economy, but it also takes a critical look at social history. And I've been fortunate enough to come across a large archive of a couple thousand photos and hundreds of hours of video that actually document some early gay and lesbian after-hours clubs and bars from about 1960 to 1990. And like you can do when you have evidence like interviewees, narrators, and pieces of ephemera, you can flesh out this history and start to see how this narrative really can be constructed in so many ways. One of the things that you deal with in gay and lesbian history is that there are certain narratives. There are certain stories that we hear all the time. We hear about Stonewall. We hear about Harvey Milk. We're currently hearing a lot about gay marriage. And gay marriage is not a new thing. This debate has been going on for quite some time. The Lambda Legal has been dealing with the issue of gay marriage since the late 1970s. But as of right now, it's taken the forefront. With this history in Pittsburgh, we're starting to find out that its narrative doesn't necessarily follow that same national narrative, which is really punctuated by political movements. This narrative is talking about men and women who grew up and stayed in Pittsburgh and used the pre-existing social realms that they lived in, you know, social clubs, after-hours bars, places that you can hang out, and they made those spaces their own through a number of means. It might be through a sort of underground economy. It might be through neighborhood relationships. But they very much shape the city in their interest. A key number of people shape the city in their interest, and it's a remarkable history that very much changes this idea that nothing's going on between the coasts, and if you grow up in Pittsburgh, you either move to San Francisco or you live in the closet. That paradigm, I don't think, should exist.
What are some other ways that the narrative of gay history in Pittsburgh differs from the national narrative or the New York narrative?
Well, some ways that Pittsburgh differs are sort of ones that you would think of immediately. Pittsburgh's economic crash in the 1980s, which was significant compared to the rest of the country, if only because of the fall of the steel industry, that takes a great toll on everybody living in the city. And I think that's another thing to point out is that it's GLBT History Month, and I'm glad to get some attention for this project. But most importantly, it's not just a gay and lesbian history. It's a Pittsburgh history. And it doesn't simply involve gays and lesbians either. It involves those whom they had to work with to create space for themselves in the city, be they judges, liquor agents, policemen. These are the characters that are also a part of this story.
We're talking with Harrison Apple, currently the artist in residence at CMU's Center for the Arts in Society. He's working on a project looking at gay and lesbian nightlife in Pittsburgh between 1960 and 1990. Ultimately, what form will your project be taking?
In May 2014, we're launching an exhibition at the Future Tenant Gallery in downtown Pittsburgh. It'll be open at the start of May, and it should run for about a month leading up to the Pittsburgh Pride Festival, which is perfect timing. But that's the first solid form that it'll take outside of the research and archive. And what we're also planning to do is to use that exhibition space as a public programming venue so we can pull in a multi-generational audience, those who experience this history firsthand and those who will be seeing it for the first time. And I think those conversations are something that are really difficult to get, especially given that today's youth group, today's youth demographic for gays and lesbians are at a disadvantage to know their own history. With the demise of nearly a whole generation to AIDS, there's a huge age gap that does have its effect. These stories don't necessarily get told, and this will be an opportunity to tell some stories.
What are What other archives are there that look at gay and lesbian history in Pittsburgh?
I think most well-known might be the Teeny Harris archive at the Carnegie Museum. Teeny Harris took a lot of vernacular photography at nightclubs. And of course, in the nightclubs in the 30s and 40s, you have female impersonators. And I've met a couple of people who have done some published writing on this project. And I've met some narrators who have given stories for this project. And it's a really phenomenal piece of history to have, and it's really a blessing that it's still around. But besides the Teeny Harris archive, the Pittman Study has a couple of resources which they're currently putting together into an archive, and some of the other GLBT organizations in the city, PERSED, GLCC, have their own materials that they've collected over the years, but there hasn't really been a key there hasn't been a central archive for this type of material. There hasn't been a repository for this kind of material. And I'm hoping that this project, after the exhibition, can grow to accomplish just that, where not only can I can continue doing field work and interviews, but also to have a team of archivists who are collecting and preserving this work. It's not uncommon that pieces of ephemera like photographs, letters, personal effects that fill in these narratives, it's not uncommon for them to be thrown away by the people who had them. Some people in the past couple of years in their older age have thrown things away because they wonder what their family might think. And that's a common history. And what my project does not seek to do, it does not seek to do away with the fact that there has been daunting discrimination against homosexuals in the past, but to not throw the baby out with the bathwater, and that there has, to recognize that there has been a history, and that it is certainly not just worth saving, it's crucial to the city's history.
And what are the ways in which the gay culture has influenced the broader culture, the broader popular culture in the United States, styles, trends, and all that kind of thing?
You'll certainly find a lot of evidence that says that gay culture has been a part of evolving fashion, style, trends, things as you say. But I think it's bigger than that. Homosexuals in particular aren't responsible, but mainstream culture will always look to subcultural trends. People who are, doing fabulous entertainment on their own, and those will percolate to the surface. In Pittsburgh, I can say that gay culture has influenced the city in a number of ways, including political. If anyone was around in 1988, they might remember the attempted passing of a Human Rights Act to protect sexual minorities from discrimination in home and employment, and it wasn't passed until 1990, but it was certainly a rallying point just after a trip to March on Washington in 1987. I think that Pittsburgh has been deeply affected by a lot of people who are gay and lesbian. The nightlife scene certainly has. There are a number of clubs, of which I won't name for confidential reasons, but they were popular joints. They weren't just for gays and lesbians. They were mixed crowds. But they were owned and operated by a gay and lesbian crowd, and that created a space in which that culture can thrive.
It's been said by some that equal rights for the LGBT community is the last frontier of the civil rights movement in America. What are your thoughts about that, particularly with regard to all of the things that are swirling around us, the lawsuits regarding striking down the Protection of Marriage Act in Pennsylvania, and also adding language in the civil rights ordinance that protects people based on their sexual orientation?
Sure. And a simple way to answer that would simply to say no, equal rights isn't the final frontier. And although my personal opinions aren't relevant necessarily right now to, the issues of gay marriage or gay rights per se, my focus on history and gay and lesbian nightlife is to tell a different type of story. I'm looking at the ways in which resistance isn't always openly political. And that's the type of story that I'm interested in speaking about.
Our guest has been Harrison Apple. He's currently the artist in residence at CMU's Center for the Arts in Society, and he's working on a project looking at gay and lesbian nightlife in Pittsburgh between 1960 and 1990. Harrison Apple, thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, while the government shutdown may have closed down Yosemite and other national parks, there are plenty of state parks you can still visit. We'll talk with travel correspondent Elaine LaBombe next here on Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.